Tired of Trying to Measure Up, Chapter 5, Run Over by Shame. How you doing, fat face? Not a very flattering comment, to say the least. What would your response be if someone said that to you? Would you feel hurt? Probably. Would you ignore or avoid the person who made the comment? Perhaps. Would you lash out at that person? Hopefully not. Would you confront the other person with this hurtful behavior? Hopefully. Would you feel like committing suicide? Though that may sound extreme, you might even consider suicide, depending on your inner state when that remark was made. Recently, I read about the tragedy of a family in a town not far from my home in Minneapolis. Anita, the family's teenage daughter, had committed suicide, and it came as a complete shock to those who knew and loved her. Bewildered friends said it seemed totally out of character. Anita had so many things going for her. She was a senior in high school, an honor student, a cheerleader, president of this and captain of that. Her suicide made no sense. Then some other pieces of the puzzle were revealed. Sure, she had some major bouts with depression, and there was that time when she withdrew from the family and friends. She did have a history of struggling with anorexia nervosa, the eating disorder characterized by self-starvation. Her family seemed to quickly dismiss all this as in the past. Anita had been in extensive therapy, but after that brief dark period in her life, she rebounded. She outperformed everyone's expectations. No one expected this. As we've already seen, relationships have a lot of power to communicate shaming messages to people. The truth is, Anita's choice was just the end of a long process set in motion by a comment that made her feel like a defective human being. Someone had called her fat. As Anita processed the comment in her mind, it took on other meanings that, most likely, were never intended by the person who had made the comment. She believed the gross lie that thin is the only standard of perfect beauty, that to be a few pounds overweight means you are unacceptable, and that she was, therefore, defective. That was how Anita processed the stray and foolish comment that made her feel ashamed. All processes have beginnings. Some begin at birth and are fueled by shaming messages received in the context of shame-based relationships. However, shaming messages can come from any sources, not always from long-term relationships. They can be communicated by daily events: an accident, a poor choice, a bad grade, a circumstance, a look, a comment. I'm accustomed to hearing clients' stories about traumatic events they've experienced. In addition to whatever hurtful feeling they may have felt, there's often a great sense of personal indictment for having had the experience at all. Throughout the rest of this chapter, I'll describe some of the other sources that wound and shame people. I won't offer a thorough examination of each type of event, because other books have been written dealing with each of them in great detail. My goal is simply to show the link between people's shame and certain events they experience: bad behavior, divorce, abuse, addiction, and so forth. To help you see the relationship between an event and the feeling of defectiveness, I'll present what I believe is the real meaning of the event, and then describe how a shaming message is communicated. Personal behavior. The meaning: people make choices for which they are ultimately responsible. In this world's culture, behavior that violates established social and moral standards is called an infraction of the law, a misdemeanor, or a felony. In social settings, actions that don't conform to what is generally expected are called breaches of etiquette or bad taste. In God's economy, a choice, attitude, or motive that fails to live up to his standard is called a sin. In fact, the Greek word used for sin, hamartia, means falling short or missing the mark. When we miss the mark, whether with God, family, friends, in public, or within ourselves, we are dealing with behaviors, not our value and acceptance as a human being. The message. People in various areas of society, as well as many families and churches, fail to separate people from their behaviors. Through our efforts to confront, correct, or control the actions of others, we send messages that say defective behaviors indicate personal defectiveness. Hate the sin but love the sinner is a good idea, but one that is not very often lived out. In systems that are performance-oriented, missing the mark always brings on shame. An offhanded comment, a flare-up of anger, an accident, a divorce, having an abortion, all have the power to indict. Consequently, the transgressor will carry shame for behaviors long since past, whether or not they can be categorized as sin. In a society or circle where any unacceptable behavior is shamed, the offender becomes an expert at heaping shame upon himself. In the final analysis, no one else even needs to add to it. He is already self-condemned. Divorce. The meaning, divorce is about people's behaviors and choices. It's a traumatic experience for everyone involved. When two people get divorced, it's usually the end of a long process of relationship breakdown. Ask most divorced people and they'll tell you the real divorce happened long before the date on which they signed the divorce papers. The document just acknowledged the breakdown. The inability or unwillingness of the individuals to resolve the painful issues, and it notarized their willingness to make all of that public. The message. For many people, divorce is more painful than the death of a loved one because it signals intentional rejection. A tearful client told me recently, it wouldn't have hurt as much if he had died. It also brings to the surface much of the shame that's already there as a result of living in a dysfunctional family system. Many times, the parents of a divorced couple will interpret the divorce as an indictment against them as parents. Likewise, children of divorce often feel they are to blame for the failure of their parents' marriage. These kids have probably been trying to put band-aids on their folks' marital pain for a long time, lying to others, not inviting friends over, trying to be good, or finding ways to disappear. The lack of improvement in the marriage makes them feel defective, as if they somehow should have been adequate to fix a breakdown between two adults. Since they interpret all of their own attempts to try harder as love for their parents' refusal to try harder translates into a message like this to the kids. Even though you love us enough to make our marriage work, we don't love you enough to make it work. Or, nice try, kids, but you didn't do the right things to save our marriage. Because children normally see things from a self-centered viewpoint, they do in fact receive messages of defectiveness like this, even when they are never intended. For the divorced adult, his or her inability to resolve problems also translates into personal defectiveness. What's wrong with me that I couldn't work this out? How could I have picked this person in the first place? I should have listened to so-and-so. What will people think of me? This is compounded when one spouse wants to reconcile and the other doesn't. In addition, Other people, churches, and society in general contribute to the shame already there with attitudes and comments that insinuate that divorce makes you less of a man, a woman, or a Christian. A comment I hear quite often from divorced clients is this: I'd feel more accepted in church if I had murdered someone. In cases where a spouse has had an extramarital affair, their mate is left with the message that there's something wrong with them, and that's why they have been replaced. Most will never see their spouse's affair simply for what it is, an immoral choice made by another person. Often, they go to great lengths to improve themselves in order to win back their spouse. They set up walls against future relationships to prevent further hurt and shame. Sometimes they rush to replace their lost spouse with another relationship in an attempt to drown out the voice that says, "Something's wrong with you." That voice comes through even more loud and clear if their spouse decides to leave them and remarry. And where children are involved, desertion by a parent can be more difficult than losing him or her through death. Addiction. The meaning. Addiction is simply the end of a course of action designed to fill inner spiritual emptiness with something that can't fill it. It is the result of an attempt to meet inner needs with external substances or activities. People can become addicted to many things. If a person believes that money, work, food, diet, chemicals, exercise, a relationship, or a ministry has the power to meet his needs and make him a more valuable, acceptable person, he will set out on whatever course is required to obtain it. He may pay dearly in other areas of his life to have it. He might sacrifice money, sleep, meals, integrity, or time with others in order to possess a given object or attain a given goal. In addition, once he's invested so much of his life's energy in pursuit of such an object or goal, it becomes easier to continue investing than to let go of what's already been invested. And once he possesses what he sought, he's not likely to let it go without a fight. The message: addiction devastates relationships. The addictive course of action consumes most or all of the addict's emotions, effort, and energy. Therefore, others suffer neglect. Regardless of what words are spoken, what is communicated to those who care about the addicted person is this: you are not important. My addiction is not negotiable. You and your well-being are. It's okay for me to take you for granted. The can't talk rule is the primary mode of operation where there is addiction. When a person attempts to meet his needs through a negative addiction, alcohol, drugs, sex, food, gambling, family and friends are ashamed for taking notice. The fact that there is an addiction is so shaming that anyone who notices the problem or confronts it out loud becomes the problem. And when a person tries to meet his needs through a positive addiction, work, ministry, friendship, those who try to help are shamed for questioning, because the course being pursued here is, on the surface, desirable and acceptable. The one who confronts this kind of problem is treated as petty, unreasonable, unspiritual, oversensitive, jealous, selfish, or critical. Additionally, people affected by someone else's addiction react psycho-emotionally by learning to adjust their thoughts and feelings in order to make sense out of a painful situation. In other words, they learn to pretend not to notice what they see, think what they think, or feel what they feel. Functionally, people react by learning to contribute more compensating for the fact that the addicted person is contributing less. Both reactions are an attempt to overcome, undo, or at least cope with the presence of the addiction. Unfortunately, these reactions actually help perpetuate the addiction. Therefore, a sense of failure and shame transfers to those who would like to help. Usually, they try harder. At some point, it becomes easier for them to continue investing more emotion and energy to recover their loved one than to let go of what they've already invested. Admitting to a lack of control or admitting you can't recover someone alone is equated to an admission of some inner defect. The one who would help is now in his own addictive process, believing that a certain course of action, their efforts, can fill their inner emptiness, shame. Abusiveness. The meaning, like the other issues discussed already, abuse is a complex subject. What further complicates it is the fact that there are so many forms of abuse. There is sexual abuse, incest, rape, sexual molestation, and other violations of persons' sexuality. There is violent abuse, physical injury to spouse, children, or the aged. And there is psycho-emotional abuse, verbal abuse, or neglect. One great obstacle to recognizing and combating abuse is the lack of a clear definition. What is abuse? When is behavior towards someone abusive? Abuse, in my definition, is when person A uses his power or his position and authority to force person B to perform in order to meet the needs of person A. Most people define abuse only as hitting or molesting. They overlook all of the subtle and sometimes more damaging forms of abuse. By my definition, when a parent uses his or her authority or power solely to control a child to act in a way that meets the inner need of the parent, it is abuse. It is abuse whether they control through the use of violence, a loud voice, threats, manipulation, or Bible verses. For example, I may want everyone in my church to respect me as a good Christian father, but at a church picnic, my kids get tired and whiny. Many Christian parents feel that a child should never show his tiredness by complaining, but always be perfectly polite in front of other adults. In other words, be more perfect than they are themselves. If my self-esteem and respect from others is threatened by my children's misbehavior, then I'll be more concerned about knocking them into line than I am concerned about their physical need for quiet and rest. I may even belittle them in front of others or lecture them from the scriptures. This is putting my needs before theirs. This is abuse. There are several issues at work within the perpetrator of abuse. His own shame, his unmet needs, his lack of appropriate skills in meeting his needs, and his struggle to seek some external means, the performance or behavior of someone else, to erase or temporarily forget his own inner sense of defectiveness. The flaw in this method is that no one's shame can be eradicated by the performance of another. The sense of being flawed is further compounded by the fact that once the incident of abuse is over, the abuser experiences even more shame. Violent sexual abuse is an extreme expression of the offender's inner shame and rage and desire to punish. The sexual organ is simply the weapon of choice. Incest is the attempt of the offender to meet his unmet need for love, acceptance, and intimacy with a person who is less able or willing to reject him than others have been. Sex is simply the means. Covert forms of sexual abuse, exhibitionism, voyeurism represent still safer ways for offenders to attempt to meet needs or act out inner pain. Again, sex is simply the method. Violent physical abuse is the extreme attempt to control another person. It's so important to an offender that another person act in a certain way that he controls that other person's actions by inflicting harm. Control is the main issue for these abusers. They attempt to control another while neglecting to control themselves. In addition to physical battering, other extremely damaging abuse occurs when the abuser acts violently towards pets or the possessions of the victim. Sexual activity against the victim's will, battering during the sex act, and forcing someone to perform sexually in a way that's humiliating are other forms of abuse. Psycho-emotional abuse is, in some ways, more damaging than physical abuse. Black eyes are at least a tangible evidence that abuse has occurred. Wounds to the heart are deeper and invisible to others. Again, the attempt to control another seems to be the main issue in this type of abuse. Verbal abuse, the most easily recognized form of psycho-emotional abuse, includes name-calling, put-downs, comparing to others, raising the voice, and threats. There are other more subtle forms of abuse, including drawing the attention of others to a person's mistakes in order to humiliate him, threatening violence, threatening suicide, threatening loss of contact with important people, I'll take the kids, shaming the person for wanting to improve his or her situation, like by getting a job or going to school, withholding money from a spouse or blaming him or her for a weak financial situation, constant complaining before and after a spouse goes out so that having friends hardly seems worth the hassle, possessiveness, like making accusations, badgering or excessive questioning, punishing for eye contact with members of the opposite sex, taking the keys or distributor cap from the car. What's significant about these kinds of abuse is that they usually take the form of a process that begins small and increases over a long period of time. The message: abuse, in whatever form, is extremely shaming. Sexual abuse relays the message, my needs are the most important thing. You are someone to be used, and it doesn't matter if you don't like it. Sexual abuse, where there is a can't-talk rule and a threat, keep quiet or else, is doubly shaming to the victim. It relays the message, I'm doing this bad thing to you because you're worthless. In fact, you're so worthless that I can do whatever I want to you and get away with it. Victims have a hard time reporting the abuse or even talking about it for a number of reasons. Often they feel responsible. For instance, most battered women feel they somehow deserved the abuse. Often victims say, I should have known better than to go there, or say this, or do that, as if they were to blame for the abuse. None say, I am more valuable than that, and I didn't deserve to be treated that way. In addition, they are afraid of what people will think, of what the perpetrator will do, or that no one will believe them. Many of my clients have actually been asked by family, friends, clergy, and other counselors, what do you think you said or did to cause this to happen to you? Let me ask a question. What's a good enough reason to excuse abuse? There is no reason good enough. Maria was sexually abused early in her adolescence. Legally, what happened to her is called rape. Only after months of therapy was she able to see that she was not the cause of the abuse, just because she was infatuated with an older boy, or because she trusted him not to abuse her, or for being at the friend's house where the rape occurred. Could she have made other choices with this situation? Perhaps. But there is no combination of wrong choices that add up to a good enough reason for someone to be raped. All abuse is a violation of the inner boundary of another. An inner boundary is an invisible line inside, which, when crossed, violates a sense of well-being or worth. Abuse occurs when, knowing these boundaries exist, they are nonetheless consciously crossed so that hurt or punishment occurs, or force is used to meet the desires of the offender. In fact, an abusive impact occurs even when boundaries are crossed unintentionally. If a woman threatens her ex-husband, telling him she will refuse him child visitation rights unless he does thus and so, that is abusive behavior and a violation of personal boundaries. If an older sibling ignores the cries of a younger sibling and demands that she play sexual games or else, that is abuse and a violation of personal boundaries. In cases of sexual abuse, personal boundaries are violated by the wrong person in an inappropriate way and at an inappropriate time. The result in the victim is a sense of confusion about appropriate sexual boundaries. They question their right to even have boundaries, sexual and otherwise. Abuse relays the message, "I can do this to you because I'm bigger or stronger or faster or louder or male. You're defective and powerless to prevent this from happening. You're responsible for this abuse because of your lack of performance. You're only getting what you deserve. You are also responsible to stop it by performing differently." The bottom line message of all forms of abuse is this: your needs don't matter, your feelings don't matter, what you think doesn't matter. You are defective and you are the problem. Suicide. The meaning. I believe suicide takes place when a person gets skilled enough at hating himself. It's the most extreme result of the process set in motion by shame. When someone takes his own life or even attempts to do so, anyone who cares about him is going to be affected. Nevertheless, suicide makes a statement about the choice and behavior of the victim. It says, "This is the way I have decided to deal with my pain." Survivors will feel sadness, confusion, hurt, and a host of other emotions. They'll miss the victim. They may feel angry at themselves and at others. At some point, perhaps not immediately, they'll be angry with the victim as well. They might even feel afraid for themselves or others they know. If I failed to notice how much he was hurting, what else might I be failing to notice? They may also experience some depression. All of these emotions are a normal, healthy human response to a terrible loss. A healthy grief process will eventually resolve them. The message. For some survivors, however, a very unhealthy connection is made. A message is internalized. It is as though, through suicide, the victim has said to the survivor, "You are not valuable or important enough for me to stick around. I don't care how you feel. You are somehow responsible for what's happened and you are powerless to change it." The victim's real statement, "I hate myself," translates into, "I hate you." Clients' statements to me indicate that the shaming message of suicide does get through. If I were a better dad or mom or friend or pastor or counselor, this wouldn't have happened. I shouldn't have done this or that. They committed suicide because of me. Sometimes the victim has even left a note that blames other people directly. Another common reaction of a survivor is this: "I should have known." The truth is that most people who commit suicide do signal their intention one way or another, but often the meaning of certain actions or conversations becomes clear only after the tragedy. The friends or family ignored or misinterpreted the meaning of certain signals unintentionally. Depression, chemical use, withdrawal, the sudden dispersing of personal belongings, or direct threats of suicide were interpreted as having a lesser significance. Even in those cases where the victim gave no signals whatsoever, survivors believe they should have known. The bottom line message perceived by survivors is, something's wrong with me. I'm a bad person because I was unable to give help. Oftentimes, a survivor experiences such shame that he tells himself, it should have been me. Sometimes this results in their own attempt to eradicate shame with the same, quote-unquote, solution, or by turning to other harmful ways of escape. A comment. The comment that opened this chapter was made to Anita by her dad many years before her death. It could have been made by her brother or a friend or a boyfriend, a grandparent. It wouldn't have mattered. A great irony in all this is that Anita was not overweight. And even greater irony, however, is that he was a loving dad, a dad who respected his daughter. He wasn't trying to shame her or compare her to anyone he admired more. He wasn't trying to get her to lose weight. He was only kidding. And he was oblivious to the fact that his comment had punctured her soul like a dart. Anita was wounded. A comment intended to show affection had been received as an indictment. The fact that it came from a person who was important to her gave the comment its power. Others laughed when he said it, more power. No apology, more power. Anita's adolescent body was going through a major transition, and she was already very self-conscious. More power. To complicate things even more, Anita's style of handling problems and pain was to try harder. Therefore, the comment was taken as a challenge. It seems that the very moment Anita began to define herself as an overweight person, other things took on different meanings in her life as well. Understanding problems and solutions became simple. She was the problem. That became a grid through which everything in her life was filtered. The opinions of others shamed her. Her weight shamed her, as did her body, pictures of models in catalogs, even mannequins in store windows. The solution was to stop eating. She even experienced a sense of shame every time she was hungry. She also became depressed because she seemed powerless to bring this weight problem under control, quote-unquote weight problem. This added to her depression. People who are starving experience a physical, mental, and emotional shutdown. At first, others complimented her on how good she looked. She didn't trust their motives and didn't believe their compliments. Later, they began to express concern. Anita interpreted their concern as an indictment on her solution and therefore an indictment on her. She began to withdraw from friends and family. Emotionally and psychologically, she, quote-unquote, disappeared by losing more weight. At this point, the family intervened and brought her to a therapist. No one could believe the therapist's evaluation that Anita's depression was a result of anorexia, an emotional disorder. Everyone believed the opposite to be true. The lack of appetite was caused by depression. Sessions with another therapist culminated in Anita being given an antidepressant. It also got her a lot of attention she didn't want. She forced herself to eat and threw herself into schoolwork and activities. No one understood that Anita's accomplishments only served to refocus people's attention from a set of negative outside behaviors to a set of positive outside behaviors. No one but Anita knew that her shame and pain remained despite her positive facade. No one could have believed the chain of events begun by an innocent yet ignorant comment made in jest so long ago. One day, Anita, quote-unquote, disappeared once and for all, and everyone said it was senseless. But lots of things begin to make sense once you understand the power and the effects of shame. Perhaps one of the hardest forms of abuse to understand and to recognize is what I call spiritual abuse. It is the subject that we will turn to next.